You are listening to the Gable Media Continuing Education podcast feed, the most entertaining and convenient way for AEC professionals to get continuing education credits, including AIA-approved courses. As a Gable member, just listen and follow the link in the show notes to take a brief quiz and obtain your credit today. Enjoy.
I'm architect Nikita Reed, and I'll be hosting Spooky Smart Reuse, tips, tricks, and lessons learned in adaptive reuse. I'll be sharing the sequence, cost savers, and some pitfalls to avoid. Plus, there'll be a live Q&A. And don't forget, Gable members attending live get one LU elective AIA credit. Make adaptive reuse less scary.
Welcome. For those that don't know me, my name is Demetrius Lynch. I am a co-founder and chief creative officer at Gable Media. If you don't know, Gable Media is founded and led by two architects, including myself, and we've set out to tell the stories of not only the profession, but the building industry at large. As people are coming into the session, I invite you to jump into the chat wherever you are and just kind of let us know where you're checking in from. And while you do that, I want to quickly tell you what this series is and why you should keep an eye out for future events. The Gable Media All Access series is an exclusive event where we bring together leading professionals from the AEC community in an intimate setting designed for meaningful connections and impactful discussions. This isn't intended to be your typical webinar. This session offers Gable Media members the unique opportunity to engage directly with some of the industry leaders that you probably already know and listen to, hopefully every day, exploring vital topics, discussing the latest trends, and identifying innovative solutions that are shaping the future of AEC landscape. With limited participants, you'll have an unparalleled access to ask your most pressing questions and gain groundbreaking insights that can propel your career and projects forward. But before we begin, we have a few housekeeping items to get through. If you're not currently a member of Gable Media, there's still a chance to receive AIA credit for this session by becoming a member today. Just so you kind of understand the benefits, you'll get access to credit for today's session, hold your spot for future sessions, and you'll gain access to our innovative podcast-based CE program, which we already have 60 courses available right now and even more on the way. And you get an inside scoop to other Gable Media events and perks. Gable Media is an official AIA continuing education credit provider. There are particular standards we have to meet, so feel free to contact us or AIA if there are any concerns about this program. This session is not an endorsement by AIA of any materials or methods of dealing with products. The intent of the session has been reviewed and approved by AIA, so all Gable Media members will receive one LU credit for attending today's session. This is an HSW. Today's discussion will be led by Nikita Reed. Nikita is an award-winning architect with experience in rehabilitation and sustainable reuse of historic buildings. She's an associate principal at Quinn Evans, a lead accredited professional, and a certified passive house consultant. She serves on the board of the Baltimore Architecture Foundation, the Zero Net Carbon Collaboration for Existing and Heritage Buildings, and Built Buildings Lab. And as a host of Tangible Remnants podcasts, a podcast that demystifies the building reuse process for building owners and developers, make sure to subscribe to that if you haven't already. Nikita, we are excited to have you hosting this session of Gable Media's All Access series, Spooky Smart Reuse Tips, Tricks, and Lessons Learned in Adaptive Reuse. Nikita, I'll let you take it away.
Awesome. Thank you, Demetrius. And happy Halloween for all those who celebrate. I am so excited to be here talking about adaptive reuse. Let me go ahead and share my screen, and we're going to jump right in. All right. So as Demetrius mentioned, I am an associate principal at Quinn Evans,
as well as the host of the Change Over Minutes podcast, and also one of the co-chairs of the Zero Net Carbon Collaboration for Existing and Historic Buildings. So basically what that means is that I really, really enjoy existing buildings, talking about existing buildings, helping people understand what you can do with your existing or historic building, and also helping other architects and building owners get out of their own way and do things in the right order to remove some of the scariness around adaptive reuse. And so all of the letters that you're seeing on the screen, I have a lot of letters after my name. And so NOMA stands for the National Organization of Minority Architects. I am one of the few licensed Black woman architects in the country. The stat that often gets said is that we've sent more people to space than there are licensed Black woman architects in the U.S. I'm also a member of the American Institute of Architects. I'm also a LEED accredited professional and also a certified Paths of House consultant. So really dealing with architecture and existing buildings and sustainability. The reason why you should stay, aside from learning all about adaptive reuse, is also because at the end there is a QR code that you'll be able to get all of the notes and some other resources from this presentation. So stay around at least to the Q&A so you can ask your questions and also download that resource. All right, so for the next 50 minutes, hour or so, what we're going to talk about, we're going to go through the order of operations.
Your partial access code is T. Your partial access code is T.
And why getting the sequence right is so important when it comes to adaptive reuse. I'll talk through some lessons learned, the common pitfalls, how to avoid them. We'll give you some tips and tricks. And then there's also going to be a live Q&A to get a lot of your questions answered. There's also going to be a couple polls throughout. So we'll be using Mentimeter. So be sure to either have your phone ready or be ready to click on that website so you can participate in those polls as well. And then I wanted to also show you one of the projects that I had fortune to work on through both the getting it LEED certified and also helping on the tax credit side of it. And this is the Packing House in Cambridge, Maryland. And so I wanted to start with this image just to also let people know that when I'm talking about existing or historic buildings, I'm not just talking about the beautiful ornate, architecturally high-style buildings, even the very mundane existing vernacular buildings that are really the backbone of a lot of our backdrop in the U.S. needs to be considered to be reused and preserved or adaptively reused into something else, just to make sure that we are not just throwing away good buildings. So we're going to jump into why sequencing is everything. And by the way, I hope you all appreciate the orange and black Halloween theme. If you couldn't tell, we definitely were trying to lean into the spookiness of celebrating the date, so enjoy. So, stage by stage, there's four different things that we want to make sure that we're doing in the right order. So step one is really making sure that you're doing a feasibility and assessment, and I'll dig into each of these in subsequent slides. The next one is making sure you understand your stakeholder alignment and your funding strategy. This is really going to drive a lot of the design and what is needed and going to tie right into the approvals navigation and the design phases. And then ultimately, all of this, of course, is leading to construction and commissioning to make sure that the building is designed and then operating the way it was designed. So digging into feasibility and assessment. The biggest thing that often happens is that someone will come to us and say, hey, we have this idea of what we want to do with this building. We think we should be able to get it through the city or the state, or someone's going to donate it to us at some time in the future. But the client that comes to us doesn't actually have site control of the building. So making sure that you understand who has site control of the building, as well as you understand and they understand actually what the pathway to site control is if they don't currently have it, can really help get ahead of a lot of the issues that we'll get to once we get to the stakeholder piece of it. The next piece is really understanding the existing condition of the building. So that's going to take the form of doing an analysis where you're going through, you're looking at the structure, the envelope, all of the systems in the building, bringing in other consultants or engineers as needed so you can really get a holistic assessment of what's there. You're talking to civil to understand what type of utilities are going into the site, as well as are there different utility heavy ups that are needed. For instance, if you are changing the use of a building, from something that was, let's say, a lower use to a higher use or more intense use. For instance, if you're going from office to residential, you need to be mindful of, well, how much water is coming to the site? And if it was only designed to have to handle a couple toilets for office folks, but now you're adding in more more bathrooms, more kitchens, because it's a multifamily building, you need to be mindful of what the utilities are in the street. And so starting with the building condition analysis helps with that. In addition, understanding what's the electrical system looking like, what's the load looking like, does that have to be heavied up? The other piece of the feasibility and assessment is understanding the regulatory review. Is it listed on a national or local register? Is it in a historic district? And what are the zoning and code compliance items that are needed? Oftentimes, people come to us with buildings that do not currently have an ADA accessible entrance. And so a lot of what we end up doing is having to design and understand ways that we could actually get ADA access into the building in a way that is both elegant, beautifully designed, and also provides dignity for the people needing to use that entrance so that we're not relegating ADA access to the rear of the building whenever possible. We want to make sure that everyone can have the same entry experience into the building. Moving on to stakeholder alignment and the funding strategy. Understanding what the owner's goals are and what the intended use of the building is super important, because we want to make sure that we are aligning the use of the building with what the building can actually hold and sustain. There are some times when owners have this idea that doesn't always work with what the building can physically do. And so that's where a lot of our managing expectations comes in. There's often always the reality check of the budget, because there are a lot of times where some clients have champagne taste on a beer budget. And so us being able to understand what their goals are for the building, what's the current condition of the building, and kind of what's that gap to get them where they want to go, really makes a difference. And then also understanding where are they in the funding cycle. A lot of nonprofits that we work with, they often need to do things in phases, which is totally fine. And so what we will do is we will do a first initial phase, get some concept renderings together that they can then use those renderings to go out and fundraise to get more money to then fund the next portion of the work. So a lot of it is really understanding the funding strategy up front so that as architects, we're able to be helpful to our client to help them get the collateral that they need to then be able to go and raise more money to keep the project moving forward. Approvals, navigation, and design phases. So this one I'm going to dig into with more diagrams and a little bit deeper, because there are a lot of misconceptions around approvals that I just wanted to jump into to demystify. So when dealing with a historic building, and we're going to say, actually, we'll say take a step back, an existing building or a historic building, the two things that typically are going to drive what is required and what's going to be needed for the approvals is the preservation listing and the funding source. And so you'll see on the left-hand side of the screen, the funding source could be anywhere from 100% private all the way down to pursuing federal historic tax credits. On the preservation listing across the horizontal axis, it could either be a building that has been determined that it's eligible for listing on the National Register, but it has not been listed yet. Or it could be a building that is an existing building that's located in a National Register district, but it's been determined that it's actually not contributing. So it's really just an existing building, all the way over to it's being listed as a National Historic Landmark. And so depending upon the matrix of the funding and the listing, it's going to determine who has to approve what. And so in this next slide, you're seeing what that matrix looks like. And so, for instance, if you have a project that is going to be funded by federal grants on the left-hand side, and then it is individually listed on the National Register, if you go to the intersection of those, you'll see that it has to be approved by the SHPO, which is the State Historic Preservation Office, as well as the sponsoring agency for Section 106. And so each funding source and their listing dictates who needs to be approved officially. And this is outside of the stakeholders in the community. And so this is just also to let everyone know there is a rhyme and a reason to the approvals process. But also, I want to point out that money really does impact what needs to be approved. Because, for instance, you'll notice if you have a building that is, even if the building is a contributing resource in a National Register Historic District, but you are funding it with 100% private money, then there's really no legal agencies that you have to go to. However, if it's a contributing resource in a local historic district, then you have to go to the local historic preservation office. And so typically the local has more enforcement authority than the national level.
even though the national level unlocks more tax credits and more funding resources. So just something to keep in mind that you want to pay attention to any sort of local approvals and local registrations that your buildings may be on. And so typically, many of us are familiar with this design, bid, build process. And these are the typical architecture design phases, starting with schematic design, design development, construction documents, bidding, construction administration, and then you get your use and occupancy. And so if you're going after historic tax credits, so just going to put a quick plug in here for tax credits, typically the reason you need to know this upfront is because that's going to impact when you needed to make your certain submissions to your agencies to get approval, and then when you get the information back. And then in addition to understanding when you want to submit your part one, part two applications, you want to get the part two typically approved before construction starts. And then once you place the building in service and you get your UNO, then you submit your part three of the application to get that certified. And then for the next 5 years, the building has to comply with all of the regulatory requirements for the historic tax credit to not be recaptured. And so understanding the approvals requirements, the navigation of it, also will help you inform your design process to, again, make sure you're doing the right things in the right order. And so we then move into construction and commissioning, because one of the things that can sometimes save a project is having a very clear phase construction strategy. And so if it is starting with abatement and demolition before you need to move into the next phase of actually doing the full fit out, then that is something that can be helpful to many projects. It's also important to have ongoing coordination with the various preservation authorities, because everyone is going to have different requirements, and you want to make sure that you're complying with all the local, so that could be your city, your town, the region, the state will likely also have other layer, and then also the national if you're going after any federal tax credits or if your building is on the National Register of Historic Places. If you skip steps, let's just talk through what could happen. So let's say you skip feasibility and you're thinking, you know what, this building probably is fine. We don't need to go and do any sort of interior assessment of it. We're just going to assume that it's fine. Well, that often can lead to some deal breakers that happen mid-design, and it could be a very expensive pivot. Now, there will always be unforeseen conditions that come up when doing an adaptive reuse project. That is just the nature of the game. But the more you can study the building, the more you can look at assessments, have conversations, do your research. And that means looking at historic photographs, looking at historic documents, sandborne maps, all of the things that you can get more information about what could happen with this building, the easier it will be and the more likely you are to uncover those potential pivots during design, where it's much cheaper to have to pivot than it is during construction. If you skip stakeholder alignment, then not only could there be scope creep because all the right people weren't at the table at the same time, and so then different voices come in that then have to be accommodated, that could lead to budget blowouts and then, of course, timeline delays. One of the big things that end up happening on adaptive reuse projects, particularly for developers who haven't done this before, is that they overpromise to the community. They say, oh, this is only going to take 6 months, without talking to anyone on the design team or any of the contractors or knowing anything about the process. And so then they overpromise to the community. The community gets frustrated because they feel like, well, you told us this was going to take 6 months and now it's been 2 years. What's happening? So being able to make sure that you have that alignment is something that will just minimize many of the issues that you could run into with the community. If you rush approvals, if you move forward into construction without having the right approvals lined up and in place, then not only do you risk rejections and redesigns, that can also really lose some momentum in the project. No one, particularly no architect, wants to get all the way through the end or almost to the end of construction documents to then be told, actually, this has to change, go back to DDs. That definitely becomes an ad service that makes the client unhappy. So making sure that you get the right approvals in the right order is super impactful. And then, of course, if you're underestimating construction complexity, there's going to be change orders, cost overrun. There's going to be a financial consideration and financial hit there. And oftentimes, a lot of the projects, particularly when there are nonprofits who are having to raise money for these projects, there's not more money that they can just keep drawing from. So doing what you can to understand the construction complexity before construction makes a big difference. And so the big key takeaway from this section one is front load the hard conversations because your future self will absolutely thank you. All right, let's jump into the first poll. I would love to hear from you. Which stage causes you the most anxiety? And so I'll go ahead and leave this up for about 30 seconds or so. Oh, and it's great to see some of the answers coming in. Stakeholder alignment and funding. Approval navigation. Yep. Absolutely. And so then I hope you'll put some questions in the chat or in the QR code once we get to the next one. But yes, that is absolutely, yes, approvals navigation is definitely the winner on that one. All right, let's move into some lessons learned. We're going to talk about some of the scary stuff and how to avoid it. So the big one, and again, I hope you enjoy these taglines. So a big pitfall is regulatory surprises or the ghost in the machine. And so sometimes clients really don't understand what changes are allowable. And so there'll be times when a client will want to do something to their historic building, and then they will be like, well, we have to do it. But if you don't let them know what's at stake if they do it and what could happen, then that becomes a problem. So for instance, there was one project we were working on where the GC was like, we could save so much money if we didn't have to restore this wood. And the wood happened to be this very ornate historic wood that was in a lobby that was a big character defining feature and a big part of what was helping the client get millions of dollars in historic tax credits. And so the client was like, oh, well, saving money sounds great. Let's not do the wood and let's get rid of it. But we had to step in and let them know, you are welcome to do that. But if you do that, you will no longer get the millions of dollars in historic tax credits because the tax credits are contingent on that wood being restored instead of that wood being removed. So a lot of times having to understand what's allowed and balancing that with what the client wants can help make sure that things move smoothly. It's also a reminder that local ordinances are often more stricter than federal standard. And that's because the local ordinances and the local enforcement is actually much more possible than it is at the national level. Even before the changes that have been happening at the Park Service with this current administration, the local ordinances and local historic preservation commissioners or historic districts, those are the ones that actually have the more teeth to enforce what's happening at the local level. And then the Secretary of the Interior Standards, there are four. And so the one for restoration is typically the most restrictive. But for many historic tax credit projects and other adaptive reuse projects, you're actually using the standard for rehabilitation, not restoration. And so that one you're able to be a little more flexible with. And so understanding the difference between the four versions of the Secretary of the Interior Standards can help also navigate that. And so some of the solutions, you want to make sure that you are doing a regulatory mapping was what we're calling it. So it's really understanding what approvals are needed. So similar to what we were talking about in section one, you want to make sure your clients know what's allowable versus what's prohibitive up front so that you can get alignment with them. And that helps minimize some of their surprises. And then a big thing is to make sure to build relationships with the preservation officers or the SHPOs, which is the State Historic Preservation Office. They really are allies and not adversaries. I know there are some architects that I've worked with where they have a very negative connotation of the Historic Preservation Office or the Historic Commission, or as I've heard it called, the Hysterical Commission, because oftentimes the local commissions are very used to fighting and just saying no, that they could become perceived as in the way of progress. But most of the people on these commissions, they really do want the project to move forward. They just need to understand the thought process behind how the project can move forward and what the goals are. So make sure to reach out early and often to these agencies to keep them updated. That way, you're not only going to them at the end to tell them, hey, here's what we've done. They're up to date on the process throughout the project. The monster under the bed, budget overruns. All right, we're going to talk about windows because it's the adaptive reuse webinar. We can't not talk about windows and historic buildings when it comes to adaptive reuse, because the building envelope and particularly windows are often one of the biggest hurdles that we come across. And so particularly if you have historic old wood growth windows, those windows need to be repaired instead of replaced. And oftentimes, those windows, coupled with either an interior or exterior storm, are able to have the same performance qualities or very close performance qualities to new windows with insulated IGUs and all of that. The best part about reusing and repairing existing wood windows is that they will last longer because they can actually be repaired, as opposed to many of the replacement windows that are on the market now. The replacement is right in the name. So any window that's a replacement window that's going to have to be installed, it's going to have to be replaced within 20 to 30 years. Whereas those wood windows, you can keep repairing them and replacing glazing and pieces of them as needed. So understanding the windows, understanding the roof, and also understanding the insulation is super important. As building codes have evolved, historic buildings are no longer exempt from having to comply with the energy codes. And I think that's a good thing. Historic buildings should not be exempt from it. And there are ways to creatively provide insulation on historic buildings and really make the buildings high performing. The other thing that often happens that causes budget overruns is all the unforeseen conditions, hidden structural issues, hazardous materials. You're going to make sure that you are testing for asbestos and lead and you understand how those items need.
Your partial access code is D. Your partial access code is D.
Need to be abated before construction starts. And then you also just want to be mindful that how you're going to balance sustainability goals and preservation goals needs to be thought of early on as opposed to at the end. Adding a bike rack to a building is not the end-all be-all of making it sustainable. And so the earlier you get sustainability and sustainable goals into your design process and couple those with preservation goals, the better it's going to be. And so there are various tools that you can use to assess early on. So tools like the CARE tool or C-Scale can help you get a sense from a carbon standpoint of how much carbon could be saved if you're reusing the building as opposed to replacing it wholesale, as well as what are some of the embodied carbon items of the different materials that could be in there. You also want to make sure that you're building contingency into your budgets. We typically look at doing a 10 to 15% minimum for contingency. And then also there is this misconception that you can't make it both sustainable and historic because it's going to be so crazy expensive, and that's just not true. So being able to make sure that you are looking at, yes, having the contingency, but designing sustainability early into your preservation and adaptive reuse projects can really keep that premium down. Pitfall number three, the creeping curse, timeline delays. And so it always is going to take longer than you expect. It is to get anything approved. And that be that the building permit, be that getting information back from any of the regulatory agencies, everything just always takes longer. And unfortunately, in addition to the agencies taking longer, sometimes the client being indecisive can also stall a project. If you're working on a building and the client isn't sure if they want it to be, you know, is it going to be rentals or are they actually going to turn it into offices? That changes things. Are they looking at making it rentals for students or are they actually going to make it apartments for families? That changes things. And so there is some back and forth that needs to happen oftentimes, but a client being indecisive can also stall your project, and that could be for new construction too. That's not necessarily just adaptive reuse. And then of course, funding gaps. That can also cause a pause in construction. One of the things that I do find with my adaptive reuse projects, which is a little bit different from my new construction projects, is that a lot of times the adaptive reuse projects, the funding cycle is a little bit longer than it is for new construction projects. A lot of times our new construction projects have the money from the beginning and they're ready to go start to finish. And so for the adaptive reuse ones, there's often a little bit more back and forth that needs to happen and more phasing that happens for the design. And so, again, mapping the approval timelines early to build a buffer into the schedule. And then one of the things that you could also do is use a feasibility phase to lock in the client decisions. And so what we often do, particularly when a client isn't quite sure what they want to do with the building, we'll do an early phase that can show them three options or so of what the building could be and what it could sustain before we even get into schematic design. And so this is similar to new construction as well, but being able to just show what's possible for the building often helps the client better align what their goals and their wants for the building are with what's possible for their needs. And then, of course, the phase construction can keep the momentum going, particularly if there are various funding constraints. And if there are, sometimes there's funding that's awarded that has to be spent by a certain time. And so being able to be flexible with parts of construction that can happen in the right sequence, of course, can also help that funding be unlocked and continue. All right, let's go to poll number two. So which challenge have you faced most often? And so go ahead and scan the QR code again on Mentimeter, and then we'll see what those are looking like. Yes, all of the above. For those of you on the replay, these polls won't be available, but I'll read to you what they say. So the options are regulatory surprises, budget overruns, timeline delays, or all of the above. And so far, all of the above is winning that race. Absolutely. Another shout out for regulatory surprises. Yep. And of course, timeline delays is getting one as well. Amazing. So I give that another one. Thank you so much. We're going to keep on moving. Well, time is flying by. All right. On to the next. Okay. Now we're going to get into some tips and tricks. So some budget savers and some smart moves. And so challenge, of course, as we've talked about, preservation and sustainability and functionality. That's our recipe for success. But a lot of times it's definitely feeling like all of these are at odds with each other. But it is very clear to me and to many people in the profession that are operating at the intersection of heritage buildings and sustainability is that adaptive reuse really can address climate crisis and social inequity through thoughtful design. So really being able to blend all of these items together is something that is super important. And so understanding that existing buildings have embodied carbon savings because we are reusing what's there. We're not just throwing it away to the landfill. The historic character adds value and community connection. The reason many people travel the world, go to Rome, go to Europe, go to different places, because they want to be able to see these existing and historic buildings that have been there for generations. There's something visceral about being able to stand in a place that someone stood in 100 or 200 years ago and seeing your connection to history, as well as your connection to the future. If you think about the fact that someone 50, 100 years from now will be standing where you were standing, looking at this thing. So there's that historic character that adds the value. And then there's also the reality that we like to be comfortable. Historic buildings stay and get use, or rather historic buildings that stay in use and have good stewards and help people be comfortable inside of them are the ones that are going to stay around for a longer time. So making sure that we're doing what we can to integrate our modern systems into our historic buildings without compromising integrity is really the way that we're going to keep these buildings in use for longer. So, budget saver number one, we want to make sure that the envelope is assessed early. So yes, as part of this condition assessment, we're looking at the windows, the roofing, the insulation, because those are big cost drivers, using tools again, like Care Tool and C-Scale, and then also making sure that you're prioritizing repairs, not just replacements, because you can really save a good amount of money if you're doing strategic repairs instead of just wholesale replacements. And so that comes to windows, that comes to different pieces of the cladding or the exterior, et cetera. So just making sure you're not trying to replace everything. But saver number two, phasing strategies. So you want to make sure that we are doing it in a good way. So breaking the project into manageable phases, that also helps to communicate to the clients, to the stakeholders, what needs to happen next. Because while many of us on the call, we do this every day, it is literally our job, the number of people who come to us with buildings that they want us to help them reuse, they don't reuse buildings every day. They're not in the design process every day. And so they don't actually know how it works. And so being able to help them through the process and let them know that just because you signed the architecture contract on a Monday does not mean that construction starts on a Friday. Being able to let them know all of the things that need to happen in between there helps to keep people aligned. We want to make sure we're prioritizing life safety and envelope work, particularly in the early phases, because that's going to really drive the project. And then if funding is a gap, there's always the ability to do interior fit out and finishes later in the project as funding allows. So just making sure that you are prioritizing life safety stuff. And this pro tip is that it really can keep the projects moving when funding is uncertain, because the being able to see progress and movement in the project helps the stakeholders feel like, okay, this is going to get done. Moving on to number three, certifications that pay off. We want to make sure we're leveraging sustainability certifications. And so there are a number of sustainability certifications. The ones listed that I have so far are LEED, FIAS, which is Passive House, Enterprise Green Communities, Living Building Challenge. All of these rating systems not only will make your building a better and high-performing building, but they also often can unlock different types of funding between historic tax credits, incentives, et cetera. And for instance, in the state of Maryland, if you have a historic building that's going after historic tax credits and you make it LEED Gold, you can get an extra 5% of the qualified rehabilitation expenditures in your historic tax credit. So you actually can get more money towards your historic building for making it green in the state of Maryland. And all of these also have fantastic benchmarks that can balance preservation and performance. And so the pro tip here is make sure that you're choosing the right certifications that align with the goals and the project, but also don't over-certify. We want to make sure that we are designing the building that's going to perform the way it needs to perform, but not be overly certified. And then don't worry, I'm noticing the time. I'm almost wrapping up and we're going to get right to the questions. I see some of them coming in. This is great. So this is your smart move. Your first one, you want to build your relationships with your regulators and make friends with the gatekeepers. The SHPOs, like I mentioned before, they want the projects to succeed. So talk to them early, talk to them often, and bring them in as collaborators so that you don't see them as obstacles. Because 100%, a 30-minute coffee meeting, Zoom call, virtual meeting can really save 3 months of redesign and prevent you from having to go down a path that actually is not viable. So talk to your regulators early. Smart move number two is to make sure you are educating your clients. Set expectations early and often because, again, our clients often don't understand the complexity of adaptive reuse, and you have to explain it to them so they understand. Because if you're spending more time of it and you're feeling like, oh, I'm losing something and I'm giving them all this time, they don't know that you're giving them all this time because they don't know what the process is. You also want to make sure that you are using the feasibility phase to understand the regulatory constraints, timelines, and costs, and help your clients understand what approvals are needed and who has to be talked to in which order. And then provide all of the documentation for what's allowed versus what's prohibitive. Because an informed client is a decisive client, and decisive clients keep the projects on schedule. And the last smart move is you want to make sure you are documenting everything because a paper trail can save you if and when things come into dispute. So making sure you're documenting existing conditions, so drawings, photos, reports, any approval correspondence, meeting notes, and the design decision rationale. And this is also particularly important for preservation compliance, but all of these could work for new construction as well. But just doubling down on this for adaptive reuse projects. Because the pro tip is when a dispute arises, documentation is your best defense, and the future you will thank the present you. And so the big takeaways, remember that sequence matters. You want to front load your feasibility and stakeholder alignment so you can avoid expensive surprises. Relationships are currency. So build your trust with your clients, your regulators, your repeat collaborators, your stakeholders, everyone who you would want to be in good alignment with for this project or for your project. And then adaptive reuse really is the climate solution. We can balance preservation, sustainability, and functionality. It's possible and it's profitable. And if you're curious about hearing some actually real world adaptive reuse case studies, I just published a adaptive reuse limited series that was sponsored by Quinn Evans, where I dove into four different projects. But the twist was that I interviewed my colleagues who worked on these projects, as well as the building owners who hired Quinn Evans to do the work and were involved throughout the project. Some of the projects, the interviewees included the executive director that hired Quinn Evans, as well as the current executive director who's operating the project. Other ones are the developers who hired us. So it was a really great limited series to be able to hear from both the building owners and operators and the Quinn Evans design team and how they worked together and what their experience was on the project and how they got the project from design and from concept really through construction. So that is available for your listening pleasure if you choose. There are two QR codes for you. One is the Q&A. So let me actually update that one. Let me move the Mentimeter forward. If you have any questions that you haven't put in the chat already, you can also put them either in the chat or in this Q&A QR code, or if you scan the one for a treat, that'll take you to a landing page to be able to join our mailing list, and you'll get an automatic download of all of the notes from today, all of the words from the slides, so you can have access to all of the great tips and tricks to make adaptive reuse less spooky. And so I will leave that up for a second as I go and check the chat, because there are a couple questions already. So one of the questions is, so without doing actual testing or demo, do you have any visual tips to get a sense of potential hazardous materials, abatement needs, historic curveballs, et cetera, to warn clients that are considering purchasing a building? Yes. So particularly for buildings that have been vacant for a while, when they're vacant, that often means that there's no HVAC going into the buildings. And so you're going to see the paint on the walls react differently. So typically you'll see paint start to alligatoring or start to peel off or flake. But oftentimes there is lead paint in historic buildings, particularly if the buildings have been vacant for a couple decades, or even if it's just been from like the 70s when lead paint really started being more enforced to getting buildings to be lead safe or lead free. But if you see the paint on the building, or inside the building rather, alligatoring, so it kind of looks like alligator skin, and it's kind of peeling and flaking off a little bit, it likely is lead paint, so get it tested for that. Asbestos can be in a lot of things, not just pipe wrappings. Asbestos can be in the mastic. So particularly if you have a historic floor or a tile, any tile that you see that is typically smaller in dimension than 1 foot by 1 foot, it likely is a vinyl asbestos tile. Because at one point in time, asbestos was considered the miracle material, and we put it in a lot of stuff in our buildings. And so just be mindful that asbestos can be in a lot of different places than you may think it would be. And so to answer the question, any sort of visual tile that you see that's less than a foot by a foot, it likely has a vinyl asbestos tile. So get that tested. Another one that is often, I guess those are the big ones. Oh, also double check around the windows, because sometimes there's also lead in the window frame and this window sealant as well. So those are all good questions. Other curveballs from a historic standpoint in terms of when you're working with clients who may be considering purchasing a building, look at the ADA access into the buildings, particularly in cities where there are a lot of walk-ups or steps up into the building. If there is no accessible route into the building, then having a conversation with the client about what those potential options could be is something that is going to be important up front. So those are kind of my top three things for that question. Oh, and there's another great comment in here saying, yes, also consider getting a building enclosure consultant involved. Yes, absolutely. Because they do a lot of, they handle that, and being able to work with someone who focuses specifically on building envelope is very important. So I definitely co-sign on that suggestion. Thank you, Charisse. All right. So then let's see another one. Okay. So when you have a project that requires approval from local, state, and federal preservation agencies, how do you manage conflicting requirements? What happens when one agency says yes and another says no? So that is a very good question. So a lot of times it's going to come down to understanding who has purview and what are the constraints that are going to be put on the project. So for instance, if you have a building that is going after federal and state historic tax credits, then you're going to want to take the weight of the SHPO and the National Park Service over what the local ordinance is saying, unless the local ordinance is trying to be in conflict with that one. But oftentimes when you're able to show the different agencies, well, hey, this is what the state agency is requiring, so local agency, how can you work with this?
Your partial access code is 2. Your partial access code is 2.
Or state agency, this is what the national agency is requiring. How can we work with this? They often do work together, but they have to make sure that they're aware of what's happening. A lot of times, the state and the federal are more in line with each other than the local is with the state or the federal. And that's just because of the way that the approvals process works. To submit anything to the federal, you have to submit it to the state first, and then the state submits it to the federal on your behalf. Whereas for this local, there's typically not a direct connection between the local and the state. So sometimes it's really just having to have various conversations to get everyone into alignment. So lots of talking is the big answer on that one. It's really making sure that each agency understands the requirements for the other ones. All right. So then another one, what's your strategy for educating clients who come in thinking they can do whatever they want to a historic building? How do you have a difficult conversation without losing the project? And so this one is going to be a more of a conversation and a level setting with them and helping get clear what their goals are. Because a lot of times, if they have funding for it and they can then do what they need to do within that funding source, then it's a much easier conversation than if they are dependent on a certain type of funding that's going to prohibit them from doing what they want with the building. Sometimes we do have to let our clients know that if they are able to hold out in the sense where the historic tax, particularly for the historic tax credit, the compliance period is 5 years after the building is placed in service. So basically 5 years after the building is occupied. Anything within that timeline has to be approved by the SHPO. After that 5 years, though, the building owner is released from any constraints for the most part, and they can do what they want. So sometimes it's a timing thing. Sometimes it's a managing their expectations with their funding, with what they want to do. So it's often just being able to have those conversations with them to help understand what's most important to them and what are they able to give and take on. They aren't always easy conversations by any means, but what I found is that by being very upfront and transparent with here's what is, and that could be a way to help them understand to get to what they want to do or what they can't do. A lot of times our clients, when they have the information, they're much better able to make the decisions and inform decisions, but we want to make sure that they have the right information and they understand the implications of all of the various elements that they're trying to work with. All right. So I mentioned that the building envelope is the biggest challenge. For someone just starting the adaptive reuse project, what are the red flags to look for during initial assessment? What signals this is going to be expensive? Okay, so that's a good one. So I would say the root condition of the roof. What is happening? Are there active roof leaks? How long has the roof been leaking? Has the leaking roof caused any other structural damage to the point where there's now rotted floor joist or rotted other materials that you have to be mindful of that's now become a structural issue as well? What is the condition of the exterior masonry? So really, we're going to be looking at the envelope itself. If there are holes in the building, if there is a lot of water infiltration, it's just that often lets us know that there's going to be other items that we have to be mindful of, particularly if water is getting in places where it shouldn't be, causing more structural issues. And then I would also say if all of the systems aren't there anymore. On the one hand, that is a blessing because then most of the time systems are probably 15, 20 years or at the end of their service life anyway, and technology and the mechanical systems are evolving. So being able to put new systems in is always a recommendation, but that's also a cost that isn't often calculated when people are thinking that the existing building is good to go. So being able to just know that is helpful. And then I don't see Demetrius yet, so I'm going to sneak in one more question. Okay, so when sustainability consulting looks like a cost sucker on day one, which sustainability scopes truly save money when outsourced and which should stay in-house as much as possible? So I would say any of the envelope elements, anything that you can do to the envelope. And I guess in actually, for sustainability consulting, maybe this is more a question on documentation as opposed to design. So from a documentation standpoint, I think that's really going to come down to the administrative overload. So at the moment, I'm thinking of like lead documentation, understanding all of the different pieces and elements that are going to go into it. Can really make a big difference. And so running the numbers to understand the amount of time that's going to save from an admin load is one thing. I think from a number standpoint, I find that the documentation for Passive House is much less onerous than the documentation for LEED, but the building performance requirements are also quite different. So it really just depends on what the trade-off is between the two different ones. All right, so who owns incentives and rebates and how do you verify impact? So that one is going to depend on the project and the owner. A lot of times when it comes to incentives and rebates, it's going to be the owner itself or the owner of the building or the operator of the building, or if they set up a separate entity to take it, is going to own it. So it really just depends on that. Verifying impact is going to depend on the system that it's going for. So for instance, if it's a utility rebate, then that one is going to be almost an easier one to verify because it is the consumption and the reporting out that we're able to do. If it is the tax credit, that one is fairly simple because that is a credit that gets claimed at the end of the project. And a lot of times nonprofits will get those credits syndicated. So they get equity up front before construction starts. And then the equity partner claims a tax credit on the back end. It really just depends on the project and which incentive they're going with. Which minimum investigation prevents hazardous material surprises later? An environmental assessment. An environmental phase one is a great place to start being able to understand what's happening in the building. Those assessments can also let you know if there's any buried oil tanks, if there's any other sort of soil contamination. Things like that would be super helpful. So I definitely recommend getting a phase one environmental at the beginning of the project. The last question, because I know we are over time, is what is your strategy for researching additional funding sources for client projects? So I haven't checked it since the past 6 months, but I assume the government or the website Desire, so the letter D-S-I-R-E, is still active, hopefully. That is one place I usually check because you can search by region and area, and then it'll give you a list of different grants and tax credit things are available. I also always check the state's Historic Preservation Office to understand what historic tax credits are available. The state typically also has, if it's a residential project, the Department of Housing and Finance or whatever their Department of Housing or Real Estate Development or Community Development is. And they usually list the different tax incentives that are there as well. And then I would say the third one is also, if it's also residential, low-income housing tax credits or LIHTC, and understanding what the allocations are. And so there are a number of places. But typically it's a mix of either tax credits, rebates, or grants from any of those items. And so I think I will go ahead and end it there. Thank you all so much for joining.
I'm architect Nikita Reed, and I'll be hosting Spooky Smart Reuse, tips, tricks, and lessons learned in adaptive reuse. I'll be sharing the sequence, cost savers, and some pitfalls to avoid. Plus, there'll be a live Q&A. And don't forget, Gable members attending live get one LU elective AIA credit. Make adaptive reuse less scary.